Good afternoon, everybody. It's Derek Harden again. Thank you so much for joining the chat show and joining us on YouTube and the Negotiators podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about the 11 secrets of negotiating. In fact, my negotiation system that I wrote about in Win-Win when Pearson published it all around the world, and it's in fact been translated into Chinese. Often people think negotiation is not very important. They think they don't do it. And in a recent poll on a networking seminar, only 3 out of 27 people said they were negotiators. I go, what rubbish, total and utter rubbish. We're all negotiators. We're negotiators from the moment we're born. We negotiate with our parents. We negotiate with our brothers and sisters. And then we find a partner maybe, or don't find a partner, and we negotiate with them where to go to dinner, where to go on holiday, and everything is a negotiation. Then the thing that really surprises me is people don't know how to negotiate their salary. And they think a salary offer is an offer. Well, it's the first offer, of course. Usually there's more. And as they say, there's two prices for everything. There's the price for people who accept the first offer, and there's the price for people that negotiate. Now, I've got some poll questions here for you just to have a look at, and they should be now on your screen. The first one is, do you work for a company or do you work for me, PLC? And the second poll question is, how long have you got to make a first impression, 4 minutes or 4 seconds? And these are very important questions for the mindset on negotiation. So the answers are coming in. 71% at the moment, 75% of people say me, PLC. 25% of people say a company. And 100% of people say 4 seconds. Well, that's great. And one of the first things I wrote about in Win-Win is that actually you work for yourself. And when you get the mindset you work for yourself, you sell your services, your time, your experience, your qualifications to the company, then you realize you should be negotiating for those services at every stage. And those of us who work for ourselves, of course, know that we are negotiating all the time. And you can always come down in price. But of course, you can never go up. So I'm just going to close this poll, if I may. So just talking you through what I'm doing and introduce you to my negotiating system. And the first thing I wanted to say was the reason I dressed up was you can always dress down, but you can never dress up. And therefore, you can take your jacket and you can take your tie off if that's appropriate. But if you're dealing with lawyers, accountants, and professional people, even now, they probably wear a tie. And often, and people are tending to wear a tie a little bit more than they were a year ago. So you can always dress down, but you can't dress up. And people are intimidated sometimes by the way you dress. And as we've talked about in some of the previous seminars, you feel more powerful yourself if you feel good, look good, and wear crisp, sharp clothes. So just something for you to think about while I cool down a little bit and take my tie off. My negotiating system, ladies and gentlemen, is this, and I hope you can all see that. And I've changed my office around a little bit so I can use the flip chart, which is more powerful than showing slides. But in the negotiation system, in chapter 6 in Win-Win, we talk about preparation. Number one tip on negotiation is preparation. Proper preparation prevents pretty poor performance. Fail to prepare, prepare to fail. We all know those little sayings and that go around, but actually, how long do you think the average person spends going to preparing for the negotiation? It's about 5 minutes. Professional negotiator on something that's really important under the 80-20 rule. 80% of what we do provides 20% of the results. 20% of what we do provides 80% of the results. So in those key, important negotiations, prepare, prepare, prepare. How do we prepare? Well, I'd get a flip chart out. I'd do a mind map very, very quickly of the key issues and then make a list, prepare an agenda, send the agenda to the other side, Ask them if they've got anything to add to the agenda, because that's probably giving you information that something they might raise later on. And then the key issue is, what's the best position that you want to achieve? What's your target position? What's your walk away position? And if you do walk away, what's the alternative position? And those of you that have studied negotiation from Harvard Business School or from Getting to Yes, the world famous book on negotiation by Bill Urey, will know that they call that a BATNA at Harvard, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So prepare. Number two, first impressions. That wasn't in my first book. That's in my second book. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And where are you going to sit at the meeting? How are you going to control the power of the meeting if you don't sit in the right power place? And if you want some more on that, put some information in the chat box. So think about the first impression. Then we come to questioning. The quality of the questions you ask determines the quality of the answers that you get. Most high quality questions begin with what and how. What can you pay? How can we resolve these issues? How can we get a win-win on Brexit? We really want to work together to resolve this situation. How can we do that? And as I've said before, most quality questions need writing down in advance. You can't wing quality questions, and the quality questions should go along with structuring the agenda. Then we come to listening skills. Give somebody a good listening to. Turn up the volume on your listening. Listen to the body language that comes with the information that they're telling you. Listen to what's not said, how they didn't answer your question. And remember, we've got two eyes and two ears to listen with, so make sure you've got all your kit on. And I love this. I had to buy this in a shop recently. Danger, mouth operates faster than brain. And that's really one of my ones. I've been in several meetings where people won't stop talking. Well, that's fine if they're on the other side, because while they're talking, they're giving me information. But what I don't want is the person that's with me, assisting me, talking too much, because we don't want to be giving too much information away to them. And you might be thinking, this is for high-powered negotiations only. No, it's not. Not really. It might be for negotiating with small children as well, because you need to be listening to exactly what they are saying, etc., etc. Then we come to using your brain. And I think I've told some of you that that's the chapter that Pearson didn't want to put in the book. And I think it's one of the most powerful chapters, because it talks about mind mapping, brainstorming, alpha state, getting creative ideas while you're asleep on a difficult situation, keeping a notepad by your bed and writing those ideas down when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever happens. Then we come to reading body language. It's five times more difficult to lie with body language, it is said, than it is with the words. Generally, people don't pick up the signals. Moving back, folding your arms, rubbing your nose, going a bit red, or whatever it is. And there's ways you can counter that with your own body language, but you need to be picking up the body language of other people. That's why you need someone with you at an important negotiation, because it's very, very, very difficult to pick up the body language if you are the person that's having the discussions across the desk or round the desk or whatever we're doing or however we're doing it. So take a break, take a time out, go outside, talk to your colleagues, ask them what they saw, what they heard, what their gut feel is, how much you should reduce your price or not, or what extras you might put in or out of the deal. Extras are called variables in negotiation, and they could be payment terms, introductions to other people, extras, coaching sessions, whatever. But make a list of the variables that you've got that won't affect the price but will add extra value as a USP to your client. Let me talk about liars. I put a chapter in the book about that, because clearly people are going to tell you fibs, not always tell you the truth when you are negotiating. One or two people express surprise when I work for one or two companies that people would lie. One of my questions that I ask people sometimes is, can you confirm that you haven't paid anybody more than you're offering me to speak at your conference? Well, that sort of sorts them out. And one of the questions I ask the people I teach in procurement in the NHS is, can you confirm you haven't sold this MRI scanner to any other business cheaper than you're offering me? And because sometimes the NHS isn't as coordinated as it should be, and they're trying to be much more now, sometimes companies can sell things to one NHS trust at a different price than they can sell to another NHS trust. Yeah, I know it shouldn't be that way, but you can't make it up, but sometimes it is, and that happens quite often with big companies. Then we come to negotiating tactics, a favourite subject of mine and one that we could do another session on. My favourite tactics are good guy, bad guy, linked to higher authority. I'd love to do that for you, but that's going to be very difficult to get it through the board, the committee, the association, the directors, or whatever. Remember, it's not your boss. It's never your boss, because if it's your boss, they're going to say to you, well, if you can't make decisions, Derek, get your boss in here, we'd rather talk to you, which is always why it's a group of people, a committee, etc. So you're always the good person because you want the relationship, and the bad person is the higher authority, etc., etc. Guys, then we come to influencing skills, which I've done a session on in May on the 6 traits of influence from the work of Robert Cialdini. Number one is, does the person like you or not? These are subliminal influences that we all should put in place before we do any influencing, negotiating, selling, presenting, etc. Number one, does the person like you or not? Number two, reciprocity. What can you give them unconditionally? Nothing. Number three, authority. Do you look the part, sound the part, come across as someone that can really make this happen? Number four is social proof, which is why testimonials are really important. LinkedIn's really important. I would look up your LinkedIn profile before I negotiated with you, because why wouldn't I get a feel for you, what you do, might be able to build a bit of rapport from what you've put in there. I might even find out you support Arsenal, but I wouldn't take the mickey out of you like some people did with me earlier, would I? Maybe I would. Maybe I would. And number five is scarcity. People want things that are scarce. So when I was in banking, scarce resources like lending money, like debt, look, putting applications up, etc., etc. In my case now, speaking at a conference, etc. Even people want things they can't get psychologically. And finally, commitment. When someone's committed, if you bring the price down, make sure you get agreement to the deal before you bring the price down. So if I do get the committee to agree to this, you will. We have got a deal, haven't we? Which is a yes tag question. We have got a deal statement, haven't we? Which is a yes tag question, which means they think yes. More tactics. Time. 80% of negotiations come in the 20% of the time. We were talking to Justin Urquhart-Stewart yesterday, weren't we, about the Brexit negotiations, that actually, what's the chances of there being an agreement in the next month? Probably very little. The agreement will come October, November, December, when people start panicking about the consequences, despite the Daily Mail that will be trying to put the government under pressure every 5 minutes that's going on. Probably after today's meeting with President Macron, there'll be all sorts of things in the paper tomorrow. Taking a break, taking a time out to think things through. And the final one I mentioned here, but in Win-Win there's 35 tactics, is flinching. Somebody puts the price on the table and you go, that's a bit more expensive than we were expecting to pay. Wow, that's outside our budget. What can you do to help me? And notice the hand on the heart, which is, of course, you know, a sort of Bill Clinton type of negotiating tactic, a subliminal one when you're moving. Or you go, what can you do to help me, with a little fingers, etc., and little things like that. I tend to help my clients with tactics as much as I possibly can when I'm working with them and coaching them. Then we come to bargaining skills and the old haggling skills. And the conditional bargaining is, if I do something for you, what will you do for me? And they're the magic words. When someone asks you for something, they've got something, you've got something that they want. Remember, if they want it, it's valuable to them. You may think, oh, I could give that to them anyway, but don't give it away without trading a concession back. Remember, you can always come down, but you can't go back up. And don't say the word no problem, because they just asked you for something they want. And therefore, stop, think about it, take a time out. What's the value of it? I did some work for a friend of mine just before lockdown, and he said, look, I've got nothing in my budget, Derek, but we worked together before, see what can you do. So I managed to sell him 44 of these, so at least I got some money out of it. But also, from my point of view, I got 44 of these on desks of people who might want me to use me at another time. So what I can't do, and I don't expect many people can do, you can't think on your feet of these things. You need a break, you need to stop, and you just need to think outside the box. What else can I pitch into that to make it work? Then we come to conflict. Now, there's always conflict in negotiations, which is why a lot of people don't like negotiating. And therefore, it's how we handle the conflict which is the key issue, particularly when you want to stay loved by the client for other business. And therefore, perhaps using higher authority, good guy, bad guy, really helps. So people that aren't very assertive, are a bit meek and mild in their personality, are introverts, it doesn't really matter. But let's be fair about it, none of us like conflict. It's not in human nature to like conflict. So, you know, I might say to someone like Mark, well, I'd really like to do that for you at that price, Mark. Now we've got conflict if we can't do it at that price, but I'm never going to get that through my people. So what can you help me to do to sweeten it? Now, that's a nice way of not handling conflict. The other thing I use on my seminars or where I'm coaching people is the Thomas Kilman conflict mode instrument, which is really useful because in 10 minutes you can see how assertive people are or how cooperative people are, and the dangerous people. And if it's you, you need to think about how you can move it up the scale of the people that are non-assertive, because against an assertive person, they'll probably cave in on the first price. And if you've got people working for you, guess what? That no one's going to come back and say, boss, I got a lousy deal. They're going to say, boss, they took me to the wire. And they really did take me. That was the best deal we could possibly get. And that, of course, that's the 11. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us on to confidence. And you can see why confidence is number 12 and preparations number one. And in the middle, depending on the negotiation, how important it is, you can go through the checklist and the tick list. Now in Win-Win, and I hope you've all got a copy of it, and it's only £10 on Amazon today, or on your Kindle it's £6, I then suggest that you score yourself against these numbers against these things on a scale of 1 to 5. 1, 5 is I always prepare properly for the negotiation. I look at everything, I get the drains up, and I really find out what's going on. 1 is never thought about it before. First impressions, 5 and a 1. Score yourself, and then when you've scored yourself, you can then multiply it by the factors of 4 for preparation, 1 for first impressions, 2 for questioning, 2 for listening, 1 for using your brain, 2 for body language, 1 for lying, 3 for tactics, 1 for influencing, 2 for bargaining, 1 for conflict, and 1 for confidence. I think I got that right. And by multiplying that out by 5, you get a total of 100. I did that without looking at my notes. I'm just going to check very carefully. I've got a 1 for questioning, and yep, that's right, I think. Anyway, you know where I'm coming from. Now, on a small negotiation, of course you don't go through all that, but you better do some of it, and you better think how you pitch yourself in a sales situation or a negotiation situation, or in an internal situation, think about the influencing and the body language. When I work for Barclays, I can tell you honestly that the internal negotiations were more difficult than the external negotiations. If you could get the internal pricing or whatever resourcing sorted out, then it was easier to get the external negotiations done. But I used to keep a bit up my sleeve sometimes for either the client or for the bank when I was doing those negotiations. Guys, I've been talking for about 22 minutes. There's some questions in the chat box, so thanks very much for that. From Mike Williams, can you negotiate well successfully with someone you don't like? Well, I might be asking you that question, Mike, on Monday when we're doing the international negotiations. It certainly helps if you like them, and it certainly helps if you put yourself in the right state, motivational state, the right frame of mind that you want a win-win with this person, even though something in the back of your mind tells you that, well, you know in your gut feel that you don't like them. I certainly think it's going to be more difficult, and I certainly think if they're using aggressive words, which perhaps we shouldn't use, red words, agitating words, the words we see about Brexit in the UK press that Monsieur Barnier has mentioned, probably particularly that's called megaphone negotiations, where he leaks something to the British press, trying to influence public opinion against whatever our government's doing. Yes, you can, Mike, I think, but I'd like to hear your views in a minute when I unmute everybody, but I'm going to carry on. How overcome, recover from being embarrassed from Harry? I think what you mean there, Harry, and I think what you mean is if you're embarrassed and you've done something wrong, if that's the question, I would answer that saying, look, if you've done something wrong, hold your hands up and say, hey, guys, I've screwed this up. I've got this wrong. Our team's got this wrong. I'm sorry. Now, how can we sort this out to the mutual benefit of everybody? Certainly in the engineering sector that I'm talking to next week, of course, they play very much hardball. And of course, what the negotiators in that sector are looking for is personal bonuses for reducing the amount of the contract as much as possible. And their biggest issue is at the end of the contract, withholding the last 10% that they want to get back. From Tim, how do you keep the discussion based on value and not on price? Well, that's a really tricky one, Tim, isn't it? As we all know, that's almost in your sales pitch. That's almost in the haggling, isn't it? And that's almost making sure that people appreciate what they're getting and what value they are getting out of it. And don't forget, therefore, you need to know exactly what your USPs are, your unique selling points, what the value is, and that should all be in your pitch document, or it should be in your book, so you can ring them off at that point. British retailers, and I guess in the States, people like Walmart are hugely aggressive, and they are really only interested in price. But the problem is, you don't get a win-win if you screw the screw the manufacturer or the person down to such a lowest price that they end up going into Chapter 11 or they go bust. How do you influence people for the first time you meet them? Well, it goes back to one or two of the things we've been talking about on previous programs. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression. So you need to get there early. You need to be as much like the person that you're meeting, which is why it's vital, isn't it, that you look at social media, look at their social media before you go in there, so you can get
a feel for them. You can always dress down, but you can't dress up. So what do you think would be appropriate? Who can you talk to find out a little bit about them before? That's the benefit of having a big network. And networking means doing your work before you need some advice and staying friendly with everybody, etc. So again, and then you can go into the more subliminals of mirroring and matching the body language, mirroring and matching the words, mirroring and matching the tone of voice, etc., etc. Guys, there's no more questions in there, so I'm going to unmute everybody, put you on gallery view so I can see you all, and who's got a question for me?
I just wanted to, perhaps I didn't express myself very well in the chat box, Derek. I was looking at the scenario where you're in the negotiation and you suddenly feel not embarrassed, but they've sort of got one on you and you're going a bit red or something. Yeah. How do you get yourself out of that and get back on top?
Okay, well, if I was going a bit red, the first thing, I whip my jacket off quick as I felt that, because I'd want to calm my body down. Now, this is a natural function. We all know what our own giveaways are, okay? And all giveaways are different, but you need to cool yourself down at that point. And in advance of that, Harry, I wouldn't, and I've done this before, if they offered me a hot cup of coffee or a hot cup of tea, I wouldn't be drinking that. I'd take it because it'd be rude not to, but I'm trying to leave it there, because you can cool your own body down if you think something like that's going to happen with hugely aggressive people. Then you come to them saying something you didn't know or something you'd messed up. I guess that's what you're talking about. And you say, well, I'm sorry, I didn't know about that. Let me investigate that and get back to you. If we could park that on one side, then perhaps we could carry on and let's see what we've got outstanding at the end. One of the reasons to send them an agenda and ask them if they've got anything to put on the agenda, it's certainly big time out of order if they haven't mentioned that the day before to put on the agenda. And then halfway through the meeting, they suddenly say, well, 6 months ago, Harry, you messed this up and the deliveries were late and our machinery was waiting for it and it cost us another £10,000. That's really out of order. You're almost in a position where you can say, well, Harry, you didn't mention that on the agenda. And you noticed I dropped my tonality when I said that. Now, if the next question was, and it's not Harry, I know, but if somebody said, well, the problem with you, Harry, is you're always late with the deliveries, etc., 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 then without using aggressive language, you might raise your voice to the level of the other person, mirroring and matching their voice. So, Harry, I'm really sorry about that, but I didn't know about it. Let me investigate that with my people, and I'll get back to you. What I will do is let's go through the rest of the agenda, and I'll give you a call about that as soon as I can tomorrow. So people in the unconscious mind will think you're someone like them if you use the same volume but not using aggressive words. I picked that up from Tony Robbins a long time ago and have tried it out. The worst thing you can do really against a bully, and it's usually a bully tactics, is to go, oh, I'm really sorry, you know, I couldn't do that, because bullies ride roughshod over people that don't stand up to them. You know, who is the friends of bullies in the playground? Other bullies. So again, and there's quite a lot of bullies in business, as we know. Another question, please.
Derek, from time to time, not just in our business, but in all business, in an effort to get a customer, to get an engagement, to get a what we believe to be a long-term business relationship, we will discount. Once we believe it's a discount once, but then the client begins to believe that that's the ongoing rate. How do you negotiate in a way that the client knows it's one off, or if they try to come back with the discount, how do you negotiate saying that was one off? So well, at the time of the sale or post sale?
By the way, guys, I will give this a caveat. The reason I love negotiating is there's no right answer. And I always say to everybody, look, there's no right answer to this. But perhaps with some of these skills, you can get a bit closer to a better result than you would have done without these skills. So my answer to your question, Tim, is that number one, you need to be very careful when you give discounts. And you need to be very careful how you give discounts. Now, I was talking about best position, target position, walk away. First of all, are you selling a relationship product, or are you selling a transaction product? Now, we need to position our transaction products, don't we, as relationship products, high value products. So how we do the USPs on that is very, very important. And then how we start off our pricing. So I would typically say my price for a talk is X, but that would be a bit higher. And guys, when you employ me for doing something, I'm letting all my trade secrets out now, so forgive me for that. But I would say X, expecting to come down. So your best position is your dream position. As long as it's not a commodity product that they can buy anywhere else, but it's a special bespoke product, start high, but you give them a discount. Now, I was talking to someone who's coming on this program Monday week. He's a great guy, and he was talking about some work he was doing for the NHS. So you'll find out who it was, Steve Head, and he always gives the NHS a big discount, and he always says that's the NHS discount for all the work you do. So they think the price is up here. He gives them a discount. That's the price he's happy with, and he's happy to continue that. I think the thing is, Tim, it's a bit dangerous giving them a one-off discount. But when I do that, I invoice them for the full amount, and I say with a 50% discount for the relationship with Tim Durkin, or 50% discount because this is on a Friday, and I don't get very much business on a Friday. My clients want me on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. There's a bit of making it up as you go along here, but you've got to be thinking outside the box. And that's why you should take a time out and think about it or sleep on it. I mean, I just love sleeping on it because I wake up with my best ideas first thing in the morning. And I call it my easy jet pricing. So that's a bit like Southwest Airlines in the States, Tim.
Sure.
So, you know, if you book... Yep. If you book a flight 6 months in advance, you get it for $25. But if you book it yesterday, it's $500.
Sure. The invoice idea is a great, great idea. Invoice and then show the discount.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
But I think you need to think about discounts quite carefully and how you position them. I don't think there's anything wrong with discounts whatsoever, because people feel good about getting a discount if it's especially for them. Where are we on the questions, guys?
Derek?
Mark, hi.
Derek, I was interested in the weighting that you apportioned to each of the 12 things on the flip chart behind you, and in particular, just giving one to first impressions. What was your thinking there?
Well, my thinking is, when I looked at this, and this is over 30 years of studying, teaching, and advising people on negotiation, when I went through the whole thing, I went through it really quickly to start off with, and then I tested it. Was it right? And I asked a few people, was it right? And was it my gut feel? And I really didn't do any research on it. It was just from my gut feel, and I feel it's right. This is the important one. Even though people think, oh, the really important ones here are tactics and body language, the important one's preparation. And the important one is going on a course, going on a seminar, playing a role play, or whatever, talking it through with mentors, more experienced people. Because when I help clients, there's often some really simple things that I haven't thought about, like taking someone to the meeting, taking the time out. And that all really comes out the preparation, including the agenda, the mind mapping, what are the facts, where are they coming from, what's their position. Let's put ourselves in their shoes. And by the way, there's a great, great little tip which comes out of the NLP area, really. If you want to put yourself in the other person's shoes, well, get out of your chair and pull up a chair which you imagine is in their office, and actually physically move and say, right, I'm in the office of Joe Bloggs. Now, they're coming in to negotiate with us tomorrow. What do you think their BPTP, best position, target position, walk away position is? Again, and it's amazing what you come up with by physically moving. I don't know what that is, Tim, and I know you've studied a lot of that, but there's something about moving when you do that. So, Mark, first impressions are really important, but if you haven't done this, you may as well forget it. And I didn't have first impressions in the first book. It was after that I was kept thinking about it, and I thought that was really important. So that's my thinking on all of them. But if you got any more questions, you want to take them offline or give me a ring, that would be great. Tony, you got your hand up?
It's very interesting, just this last half an hour, and the penny has just dropped just listening to you, because those numbers, preparation 4, influencing 3, there is certainly, as far as I can see, a direct correlation between the two. Very direct, because when you do your preparation, and this is just an observation, you do your preparation and you look at your CV, your company's CV, and the other company's CV, and then you try to see where the synergies are, and then you try to take the lead to say, this is why you should pick me over another competitor for that particular job, because I've done this, 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 and that, which actually mirrors, it all comes back to your language, what you do in your own field of expertise. And that is why that link, that 4 and 3, and it's just come together. Just listening to you tonight, how strong that is, that the preparation leads to how you are going to influence the meeting.
This brings it all out, guys. And I must have given, I don't know, 500 talks on this. No, more. Certainly to over 10,000 people. But for this, yes, last night I got my, for you guys, I got my clipboard out, started making notes, started doing some research. Then I mind mapped it. And then at 3:30, I sat in the garden. It's quite a nice day here in Guildford, a nice cream. Finished the mind mapping and then put the order down. And that's for something that I've done 500 times. So people that don't prepare, and most people don't, for anything really. And this applies, I mean, I talk about negotiation, but I do say to everybody, this applies to presenting, which is the first start. If you can't present well, you won't get to the negotiation. For selling and influencing, making sure your pitch document's right, it's got all your USPs on, it's got all your testimonials from the people that love you, because people believe what other people say. Then it comes to the influencing that you mentioned, Tony. Then we go to the haggling, because we're not going to get to the haggling process, bringing the price down or whatever Tim said. And then we get to conflict, because people don't like conflict. They're not going to negotiate properly. So I think you need to be really careful who you allow to do your negotiations, because if they don't like conflict. And in banking and in engineering and in construction, as soon as something goes wrong, the best thing to do is to take the negotiations out of the hands of the person that's emotionally involved. So in banks, they put it into a lending services department. In engineering, they probably give it to the chief operating officer. Not the people that are emotionally involved get wound up and, heartbeat goes up and do all the wrong things. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, it's setting a framework that allows you to sort of take the lead, really.
I think these should, this could move around. I haven't got any problem with moving them around. I felt they were right in 2015 when Win-Win was published. I hadn't thought of putting that one in and that one in. They weren't specifically in lying and first impressions when I wrote Power Negotiation in 2010, shortly after I met Tim in the States and was persuaded by Nido Cobain that I should get on with writing my first Power book.
Yeah, but it is the grading of importance that I've taken away.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Derek, can I just throw something in for, not every negotiation works, and sometimes, you know, despite everybody's best efforts and, you know, reading your book 15 times, you don't end up with a result. But is there another step beyond this that you recommend, that there's a process of analysis as to what went wrong, comparing, I know, against your steps, for example, which bits didn't work? Because generally you'll get a response saying we lost on price, or we lost because, you know, somebody's married to somebody else and all those factors. But actually, you know, part of it is maybe the process. And what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, Mike, we're going to quiz you on what happens in the UAE on Monday. Don't worry about it. You better come prepared for what happens dealing with the Arabs, because I know you worked out there. I mean, maybe we'll quiz you on that when we turn the recording off. That might be better afterwards. I think you should always debrief a negotiation. Now, people don't generally do that. You should brief it before you go in. You've done your preparation. You should brief the team. You must brief the team so that people are quiet when you ask the dumbest smart question. I'm a massive fan of this guy, Peter Falk, who was the Columbo. And it, of course, he always played the dummy smart technique, didn't he? You know, I don't quite understand where you're coming from, or one more thing. But to go back to your question, Mike, which was afterwards, yes, I think you should debrief it. And I think you should debrief it immediately. Immediately come out of the meeting, you should say, well, how did that go? Did we achieve our objectives? Do we think we're going to get the deal and get agreement? And if we miss it, what can we learn for the next one that we did wrong? And do you think, as you said, you know, there's the deal was already done before we went in there. They're always going to give it to Joe Bloggs, because we know often when we go for an interview for a job, and Jill was a HR director, I'm sure she didn't do it like this, but sometimes you go for a job and you feel they already got their internal candidate and they're just going through the motions because that's what they have to do. So, and then of course, if they write to you and say they didn't get the deal, then it's a question of having a further debrief and perhaps going and seeing them. Do you mind if I come round and find out? And if you've got a good relationship with the person, they'll let you. If you haven't, they won't. And you can have good relationships and not good relationships. Yeah. Certainly in banking, when we were selling a commodity product, trying to make it a high-value relationship product, and it got down to the commodity, sometimes you just felt that we were never going to win it in a million years. And I did try and stop people when I was in charge of the money transmission unit in Barclays. I did try and stop us pitching when we were being used as a, I don't know if the word stalking horse, just to get the price down for the other for the other company, HSBC or whoever it was. Good question, Mike. Thanks. Guys, I'm going to turn the recording off in a minute, if that's all right, and then we'll stay on the line and anything you want to ask me. Thanks for joining me, and thanks for looking at this on YouTube. And please give me a call, email me, or ask me to speak at your conference, because I'm sure we can save some money very, very quickly for you, your team, and for your colleagues. My name's Derek Arden. Thanks for joining us today.